My name is Luann Trost, and the title of this session is A Big Crunch, Faith and the Cosmos. As some of you already know, A Big Crunch is not the name of a candy bar. But it is a theory about how the universe may end. Now, why would we want to talk about this? We're in a lovely place like Holden. Why would we want to talk about the future of the universe? We've got plenty of things to think about right here and now in terms of responsibility for others, for creation. Tonight I'd like to continue this series on Christian faith and the future, on God's present and future reign, in connection with our theme for the summer, Thy will be done on earth as in heaven. The natural sciences are somewhat pervasive in our contemporary thought world, and it's important that we in the church, even when we are thinking about our faith, consider what the natural sciences are telling us. For I believe that it's only in connection with the thought world around us that we can make sense of our faith for others who may not be inside the circle of the church, may not have been hearing the story since they were young children. And only in that way can we reach out to people in terms of faith and in terms of the ethics that we would like to see happen in our world. How much attention do you pay to science? Do you read or hear about scientific discoveries and maybe have trouble making sense of them in light of your faith and in light of your view about God and the world? Or do you know anyone who has trouble accepting religious beliefs because they think that they are in conflict with the sciences? This evening we'll examine in several areas of physics what science tells us about physical reality and process and about the future of the cosmos. Then we will think together about the implications for our faith, about God's will being done on earth as in heaven. I'll start by giving a sort of a general overview of the issues of faith and science in regard to the future of creation. I'd like to tell you how I got interested and got started in studying this area. It was about 5 or 6 years ago at a church in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where I was associate pastor. I was preaching a sermon toward the end of the church year. I think it was Christ the King Sunday, when the theme of the lessons and the service was the end of the world, of Christ's second coming. And I still have an image of that moment in the sermon when I was preaching about that theme, and I suddenly wondered what people in the congregation thought I meant when I was talking about those things. And then I thought, do I know what I mean? Yes. I knew what I did not intend by what I was saying, but I really wondered whether what I was saying was coming across, because I didn't have a real clear picture myself of what I believed about the future of creation. So that was one part of my decision to go back to school and into graduate study, and I'm now working on a PhD in part on this area of thought. So I knew what I didn't intend by that. I knew I had some general notion that I believed the future reign of God had something to do with temporality, with the temporal process, and had some kind of event character, and that it impinges on the present. In Monday's Bible study, were any of you here for that? Dan Erlander gave a picture of biblical cosmology, that is what comes to us through Scripture, what view of the world, of the cosmos, comes to us through Scripture. And that was a picture of the dome of heaven above and the earth beneath with the pillars holding up the dome of heaven. We're quite familiar with the medieval ideas about what the order of the universe is. And I think that even to our day, there's something, and we find it in so much of the literature from Dante and others, a picture of a three-storied universe, of the earth on our level, heaven above, and hell below. And many people in the church, even in our day, take that picture quite literally, as that's the way that physical reality is, and refuse to listen to what science has told us. But for many people, that picture is very problematic, because we have, for several centuries now or longer, learned from science that that is not the physical structure of the universe. So what cosmology do we have? How do we see the universe ordered? Now, when I use the word cosmos, you probably know what I mean, but just in case, I looked up the dictionary definition. It means the universe considered as a harmonious, orderly system. The word cosmos comes from the Greek, meaning universe or harmony. So science tells us that there is no three-storied universe, that that's not an accurate cosmology. And most of you probably know the history of conflict between science and religious thought. Many years ago, Galileo, who tried to bring Copernican theory into his world, his work was banished by the Catholic Church in that day. And there was a history throughout the ages of conflict between the church and science. The church, for various reasons, felt that if the new ideas about science took hold, that somehow would threaten the faith of the church, because in that time, and it's somewhat to our day, the stories of the message of the Christian faith was tied very closely to a picture of the universe. It was a type of a picture of physical reality that was based on what Aristotle had thought about the way the world was. So it was a particular scientific cosmology, but the church believed that was the right one because it's the one it had then. And so I think that's crucial for us to remember when we look at changes in scientific cosmology, that the faith of the church need not be tied to one particular cosmology, but as cosmology changes, we need to reinterpret our faith in light of the changes in science. So part of my study is the relation between the sciences, faith and the sciences, and I believe very strongly that they need not be seen as in conflict. It's important to listen to one another in sciences and theology. It's important for us as Christians to hear what is being said about the physical world, though we don't always need to adopt every theory wholesale, because as many of you know, scientific theories themselves undergo changes. And so to adopt and tie the Christian faith to one particular theory, it would be as big a mistake as the church had made in earlier times. But I think that it is important to learn ways to connect our faith with views about physical reality for several reasons. The first I've mentioned already, that is that I believe our witness to the gospel in the world must take account of the way the world sees, the way that our culture sees physical reality, because so much of our thought is shaped by the sciences. Secondly, our faith in the promise of God can and does exist amid other fields of knowledge, and we can begin to see it in light of what we are told about the other aspects of reality. And lastly, I believe strongly that faith is not merely what it gives us in the way of existential meaning or meaning for our lives. That is crucially important. But I think the other side of that is that our faith has implications for the way that we view nature and the environment, as well as our political ethics and social justice. So that it's important that we see a tie to the physical reality, that it's not just something we see as for our individual salvation or how we as individuals find meaning. It is that too. I don't want to be misunderstood. So with that introduction, I'd like to move on and talk a bit about several specific scientific theories. I've listed them on the board here. The main one we'll talk about is the first, the cosmology. And the second and third I want to raise up because they bring in interesting aspects about the scientific view of physical reality and physical process, the way that the world works in physical terms. Yeah, I think that's not in the light here.
Quantum.
Back. Well, I can just read them for you.
Thermodynamics.
Yeah, the three are cosmology, quantum mechanics, and thermodynamics. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on these. I don't know the math very well myself, so I couldn't tell it to you if you...
It's oddly, but you're talking about science and religion. The thing that bugs most people who are fundamentalist faith is Darwin's theories. They're still trying to get that sort of...
Yeah, that's probably the main one that people see in conflict. We could take a minute or two to talk about that because it's not unrelated to this. It's a view about history of the physical world, of the organic world, the process. And,
I lived with a person who believed the literal word of the Bible as King James had it put down.
Yes.
And, the world was formed 3,000 B.C., somewhere around in there, 7/3. Mm-hmm. And it's very strange. She would not cooperate in any recycling projects and all this sort of thing.
Hmm. Because of that? You think it was tied to her view of that?
The care of the earth was not of any importance to her.
Uh-huh. So what you're saying may give evidence to the fact that view of
it was,
the world is connected to the way she felt about or treated the... Yeah, thank you.
It was sort of a strange situation.
While we're on that topic, there's something just occurred to me a little bit ago. It's never occurred to me before to think, why did they think hell was down and hot? And I just came out of this session on plate tectonics that we had.
Yeah.
And I suppose volcanoes, huh?
Maybe. Yeah.
That's interesting. It never occurred to me to ask why hell down and why hot. Well, all of a sudden, that makes some sense.
Well, it seems that all religions do have a place like Hades or as the Egyptians went across the river Styx, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They all have a place.
Greeks, yeah.
The Greeks had a place, and wasn't that down? The famous singer went down into the earth to get up. Yeah. King of the underworld had his wife.
Mm-hmm. So we can see parallels in other other religious thought forms.
But it's this evolution that really gets
bugs in. Yeah. Why don't we just stop? Take 2 minutes on this. I don't want to interrupt the flow here too much, but it is a crucial one, and certainly comes in when you talk about faith and science. I don't think it'll be settled for a long time, as far as many people go. And as you said, the basic issue there is interpretation of Scripture. When people insist on literal interpretation of Scripture, without any way of understanding the Genesis story,
that part would fit in with yours.
Yeah. Yeah, that fits into this too. Of course it does. Because any literal understanding of Scripture would not be willing to look at any other way of viewing the world. I know people who hold that very, very firmly.
There's no point in talking to them, yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very hard. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have struggles like the scientific creationists trying to get their views taught in the schools as a form of scientific thought, and the debates are very, it's very hard to see any, yeah, and usually come to an impasse. Well, we may have we may have time to get back to that at the end. Let's go on and get through these particular aspects of physics, and then there will be time for discussion at the end. Okay, so I want to talk about the future in terms of scientific cosmology, the future of the universe. Now, some of you who've heard Al talking, you have heard that, or if you've heard anything about global warming or the coming ice age, you know that there are threats to life on this Earth which will take place or may take place long before any of the theories about the end of the universe will happen, which are in terms of millions and billions of years. So that, I think, is a more immediate concern. And as Dan said in that session the other day, even our view of geological time gives us a perspective that says the Earth will live on, and it's a matter of whether we are able to sustain life on this Earth or not, even as long as life is viable, would be viable on the Earth. Now, when we talk about endings, the end of life on Earth or the end of the universe, I hope that I think many people get a fatalistic attitude, and I think that that's part of our culture and and I think that's part of the reason we need to talk about it in the church, because the future is often seen in terms of fear and threat. And we in the church have the promise of God for our future with God, and it's good for us to be able to talk about the future of life on Earth, the future of the universe, in terms of our Christian faith, and bring in the hope that we have in the transformation of life, the other images that we have from Scripture of the promise of God. So looking at the future gives us a frame of reference, a perspective for life here and now, and it says something about how we live our lives in the present. In addition, I think looking at things like geological time and the history of the universe, we begin to see that our God is bigger than most of the images and pictures that we have, and that God still cares for our planet, for its people and all its creatures, and promises fulfillment for us and for all creation. So now, on to these scientific theories. And I urge you to stop me and ask any questions as I'm going through this. As I said, I'm not going to do it in a lot of detail, but we'll just try to get the concepts across. Some of you may be familiar with this already. So the first is scientific cosmology. And this deals with the history of the universe, what the order of the whole is. It's only in this century that we've learned that the universe has a history, that it is expanding. It was thought in from the science of Newton and since his time that the universe was static, that there really weren't any changes, that the universe remained the same, in the same position, that planets remained in the same position, stars, that there really weren't any changes. It was a scientist named Hubble who in the 20s discovered that other galaxies were moving away from our galaxy at high rates of speed. If we have time later, we can go into more detail and I can explain why they discovered that, why they were led to believe that the universe was expanding. So this discovery led them to think that, well, if the universe is expanding, if galaxies are moving away from us, then there must have been a time that the universe was smaller, and that there was initially a time when the universe perhaps was infinitely dense and sort of like a point in time, and that was known as the Big Bang, when there was the density, it was so dense and hot that it began to expand in a big explosion, and that this was believed to have taken place about 10 to 50, about 15 billion years ago. And physics has discovered, and they're able to describe the conditions in the early universe back to almost T equals zero, so-called T equals zero, which is a singularity. That's a point that, let me read the definition. I'm reading from a popular version of some of this history in A Brief History of Time, From the Big Bang to Black Holes by Stephen Hawking. Many of you perhaps have heard of this book. I think it was on the bestseller list for a while. So he's talking about a singularity when a star collapses, and they believe that it's the singularity that took place at the Big Bang is similar to that which takes place when stars collapse. The density of matter and the curvature of space-time become infinite. In other words, one has a singularity contained within a region of space-time known as a black hole. And that's what happens when stars collapse. And it's believed then that the same type of thing happened at the beginning of the universe before it began to expand. So this was how the history of the universe was projected back, and that's where the term Big Crunch comes from. Another, it's sort of a parallel to the Big Bang theory of the beginning. So since the universe is expanding, there are two theories of what may be happening in this expanding universe. And they tell us, or it's questionable still, whether the universe is open or closed. That is, whether it will continue to expand forever or whether it will quit expanding and begin contracting again. So, sort of simply put on a space-time diagram, over time, in a closed universe, it will expand to a certain point, and then it will begin to contract again. In an open universe, it will continue to expand. Hawking gives two models of the open universe, but I think it's the difference is crucial for us here. But if you're interested, I think you might find this book a fairly clear explanation of these theories. I think his writing is real clear and helpful. So the popular language about these theories is the closed universe, that it will end in a big crunch when it becomes infinitely dense again and matter is compressed, or a big freeze when it expands and stars die and everything. Our sun will go out, and our solar system, our galaxy, eventually things will end in a big freeze.
Luann, yeah. The big crunch one is oftentimes, if you expand the length of time, would be more of a equilibrium or a steady state. I mean, it's more of a pulse, right? You have an explosion, a big bang, and then you come back to a big crunch, and then another big bang, and then back to a big crunch.
There is a theory of an so-called oscillating universe that you're describing. They don't know whether that may have taken place, but at the singularity, since they don't know the conditions at the singularity, it may have been a prior expansion and contraction.
I'm kind of curious how they think the whole thing is going this way, since constellations are being created, black holes are crunching things or gobbling things up in different parts. So all this is going on at the same time in different places in the universe. So why should we think that this other has to be this way, since we already have the two variations going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason that they believe the universe is expanding is because there are two main reasons. One is what's called a redshift in the light that comes from stars. That is, that the simplest way I can explain it is, it's like when you hear something coming toward you, it's at a higher frequency, and when it's going away. And that's the same with the light, as if it's approaching us, that would be blue shifted, and if it's going away, it's red shifted. That's the frequency of the light waves.
Is it going around in a circle, or is it going straight line?
Well, from all evidence, it's just going away, and but that's a good question, because science doesn't know whether in the different models, the universe would be have a different picture of whether it's sort of like the Earth of without boundaries, or whether it's shaped more like the universe. Space-time is more like a saddle without any kind of even the circular kind of boundaries that we find with the Earth. So there are different pictures of how it may be.
There's still formulating theories, in other words.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's right.
What does the word out mean in this context? Out
from away where? From the Earth.
From where?
From the Earth. And that's the thing
seems
is.
A little,
since our galaxy is all on one side, and we're on one side of that, I think that's almost like Earth-centered instead of sun-centered.
The point is that we can only observe things from here. We can't get outside our solar system and out far enough to figure out whether it's expanding the same all over the universe. It's believed that, and I think it was Hubble or one of the scientists who worked on this, who believed that it's expanding uniformly all over the universe. That it's not just going away from us. We just see it that way because that's our observation. But if we were in another galaxy, it would appear to be going away from there too. It's the image that they give, that I've often seen used, is that of a balloon, blowing up a balloon. If you have dots of ink printed on the balloon, when you blow it up, they are going away from each other. Okay. Right.
And that is helpful, because any place you are, the other dots are moving away from you if you're blowing up a balloon. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's a good image. That helps. Yeah.
I confess, otherwise I couldn't. That image is so very hard for me to grasp.
Oh, yes.
In my mind says,
it is very difficult. I've been through this 4, 5, 6 times, and it's still very hard to explain, hard to grasp. So that's about all I want to say about cosmology.
How does that tie in with religion?
Okay. I want to just go briefly through these two other theories, and then let's go on, let's touch on that, because I think these other two have something to say, too.
I know so very little about them, except just the titles.
Yeah, right. And the thing is that this is one part of physics, and there are several other parts that may or may not fit with this. Now, Hawking is one of the scientists who's trying to come up with a unified field theory, the grand unified theory of tying these things together, but so far they haven't been able to do it. So, so each of these areas of physics can be seen to be not necessarily in conflict, but slightly contradictory, or if one is true, the other doesn't quite fit. So they're still working on that. And so that's why I want to tie in these other couple theories. Quantum mechanics, anybody know what that is about? We'll just try to get a bare, minimal idea of what we're talking about here. This goal, we've been talking about the extremely large to this point. Now we're talking about the extremely small, the subatomic world. This is where, at a level smaller than the atom, and that's what quantum mechanics deals with, quantum physics. That's exactly right.
Exactly.
Atom smashers.
Yes, yeah, the particles that are smaller than the atom. There was found, was found also in our century, that things didn't behave the way that Newtonian science said they should. That if with Newton's mechanics, it was believed that if you knew the initial conditions, you could predict the outcome of an event. Now with the discoveries about these tiny particles, things don't work that way at that level. Heisenberg, a German scientist, is the one who came up with the uncertainty principle, which says that things are not deterministic and not predictable at that level. And I'll explain what why they came to see things that way. When they were working with these little particles, they found that they could not predict both the velocity and the position of a particle in the future. And when they measured the position, the velocity was, the closer they could get, the more accurate they could get on the position, the less accurate they could get on the velocity, and vice versa. So that they could only tell with statistical probability what that position and velocity were going to be. The reason that I wanted to bring this in is because that at that level of reality, of physical reality, we've come to see an element of randomness and of unpredictability. And that's important for our way of viewing the future. It's if we want to make a jump, and here we need to talk a lot further about what that has to do with the way we view reality, our philosophical views, and perhaps even our theological views, that the world is not just a deterministic world, that there is randomness, freedom, and openness within physical reality. And the same thing holds true when we look at some of the new theories coming out of thermodynamics. And so I'll touch briefly on that, and then we'll go on to talk about implications for theology. The area of thermodynamics that I want to talk about is called chaos theory. Mm. Some of you may have heard about that. I think it's really quite exciting. It's a book called Order Out of Chaos by Ilya Prigogine and Isabel Stengers. It was published in 1985, which deals with this. And now chaos theory has expanded to all sorts of other areas. It's being used in meteorology. Here, the popular story to tell, or the image, is to talk about the fact that a butterfly flapping flapping its wings in Beijing may cause a rainstorm over New York several weeks later. And that the point of it is that small fluctuations in initial conditions can lead to major consequences in that case in meteorological conditions, and in several other areas. They've worked with this in relation to water flowing and clouds. If you've watched the clouds overhead, sometimes you see turbulence in the clouds, and there'll be vortexes. And it's chaos theory that works with that. They deal with systems that it's called far from equilibrium. When conditions are not at all stable, when things reach a certain point of disequilibrium, something entirely new can happen that would have been that would not have been predictable from the initial conditions. So the main point that I want to bring out in this theory is that there's an openness and an element of novelty that out of chaos, almost like a spontaneous order, can come. So those latter two give us different ways of looking at the physical world and the way that nature works. So how does this tie into theology? We can't make any immediate jumps. I'm saying that, I want to open this up for discussion because I think probably all of you have opinions about that, about how views of the earth, of the physical world, have to do with our faith. But I just want to say in connection with that, even though we can't make any immediate jumps and say that this is how God intervenes in the world, I believe that it is in these laws of nature that God does act. I don't believe that God intervenes, that God has to intervene, because I believe that God is the upholder of all that is, and that the laws of nature are as they are because of the order of the universe that God gives to it. We've been talking about lots of views about the future of the universe, what happens in physical systems that give us a view of open future. And I'll just say one thing here, and that is that I believe that these theories can be helpful in our view of faith and of the future, and that is that God's promises of a new heaven and new earth, of transformation, are still believable within these scientific views of the world, and in fact maybe even more believable within the contemporary scientific view than they were within the Newtonian view, which said that the universe was ordered like a machine that led to ideas that God set it in motion and somehow then things just took place on their own and God wasn't involved in the process. So I think that this can give us possibilities for ways of thinking of God being very vitally involved in the process of life and of the universe. And in tomorrow's session, we'll talk more about biblical images of the end times and see what some of these things we're talking about today have to do with some of those images, and if those images can be reinterpreted.
Like Revelation.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So I'll quit there, and if any of you've been storing up questions, go ahead.
Very few people even know those terms, let alone the theories involved. So I just wonder how it will affect their religion in a practical aspect. most people can see when it gets too dry or there's too much water or things are wilting and that sort of thing. This is very interesting and the ideas are fine, but I think you'll find such a small percentage of people understand it, and many of them aren't Christian. So I was wondering just how it would really apply practically.
Well, I think that maybe now it's not very widely known, but eventually ideas from science do filter down and people do learn to think about the world in terms of, I mean, most people know now what at least have some idea about relativity, I think. They may not know what it is, but they have some notion of that's how physics thinks things work.
People who watch Star Trek.
That's a good question, though.
There's a lot of science in that. I think some of it's some resources that are scientists.
Yeah, Jeff. Yeah.
Don't you find though that people have a cosmology? I mean, just like they have
good
a theology
point.
Or they have a political view. Maybe they don't know how to name that or describe it, but they do believe something about the Earth. And even if you believe any of those, I mean, when you're describing them, I just keep thinking how marvelous the creation is, how big God is. If you have a God like that, then that's going to make a difference about how you treat the earth. If you have the literalist view of Scripture, I think then you have a different kind of God religion, a different kind of cosmology than you treat the earth. So maybe it's more a matter of helping people name what they believe about the earth.
Yeah, that.
And then draw connections.
Now, I don't know what people believe, actually, but I hunch, my honest hunch is that most Americans, at the level of images, still believe in a three-story universe. In their minds, they believe that, they know that that's not correct. But, you know, David say, our God, who art in heaven, and any ordinary use of the word heaven in our language is up. And I think, I have no any way to, it's just
I think you're right.
A sense of things, I don't know if it's accurate. That most Christians in America, I don't know about other countries, live with the three-story universe.
I think halfway, pop religiosity, but I think the other half is, and people don't, again, this is, I think ties into your question, because people have no idea this is what they're doing. I think the other half is that people live with a Newtonian universe. Yeah. We have really bought into Newton's idea that everything is ordered, that we can predict everything, and that science will solve everything because there are predictable rules. Therefore, we can put human beings at the center of everything, and if there's a problem, just turn it over to science. Technology will take care of it. That's the other side.
So
and that's why your question, I think, is so important, because whether or not we understand the details of science, we end up making assumptions based on what science is telling us. And I think we do it mostly based on Newton. We say these are the laws of science, therefore we can predict things. And what I find so important and exciting about this, and why it's really exciting for me to see you trying to tackle explaining it to people, Luann, because it's not easy, is that I think these things, such as the cosmology, the quantum mechanics, the thermodynamics, the chaos theory, all these things, they all fundamentally challenge our ability to control the universe.
Yes. Yeah.
Newton says we can control the universe because it all happens predictably. All of these things say, no, you can't. There are certain things that you can predict, but ultimately the universe is a mystery. And that's why I think this gets us so much more back to our true faith perspective. Sorry, I'm talking too long.
Oh, no, I'm really glad that you've said that, because that's part of the reason that I've gone into studying this, because I've felt like the mechanistic view of the universe, Newton's view, exactly what you've said, is gives us a feeling that it is all set, cut and dried, and predictable, and we can control it. And
it informs everything. It informs our foreign policy. It informs everything. Assumes that if you just set out the plan you want and put the money or the resources in it, it'll turn out the way it is.
Yeah, and it's amazing. You know, your question was excellent. Even though people may not know all the details of the scientific theory, it begins to permeate other things. And I've read a bit about Newtonian science. The metaphor of the machine has been carried over, was carried over into the way we view the human body mm-hmm. as a machine, mm-hmm. the way that economics was believed to work, and other areas of social functioning, that society was seen as a machine, and that it was supposed to be, there were supposed to be predictable results if something was done over here, and so human nature was even viewed in that mechanism.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of people who based theory of interpersonal relationships, I can't think of his name right now, he always raised my hackles. That you could control people by
Skinner.
Yeah,
behaviorist.
Drives me wild, right?
That's a little, that's a bit of coming out of a mechanistic view, I suppose. You can predict behavior by initial conditions.
They asked him how he could write his autobiography. Wasn't that an act of free choice? And he said, well, no. You know all the factors that went into it, you know I had to write my autobiography.
No initial conditions, you can predict the outcome.
Right. Skinner theories were dominant for a long time, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I think there's...
Well, they still are.
Yeah,
really,
just like Freudian's ideas have, in some people's minds, have never been modified either. And there's a lot of danger in those things.
Can any others of you see possibilities for some of the things we've been talking about and the way that we view other things besides science?
This may not be the direction you want to go.
No, I'll just
but
take
it. One of the things that I have a hunch of a way through this, but I'd really be interested to hear the comments of anybody in the room. Okay, we had this big Bible and science controversy, okay? It's gone on for 100 years. Pretty much got resolved 50 years ago, 70 years ago, but still going on in some quarters. And this is part of what we're talking about here. And how that nets out for you is, in a sentence, that, and then I got to follow up with the question. It nets out that there's no inherent contradiction between them, right? I mean, there is
not necessarily.
There is a contradiction between the worldview of those some of the biblical writers,
right,
and our worldview. So the question for me is then, what about ethics? But you don't want to. I mean, you're talking about a different question, but how, to what extent? See, people, I hear what I think is a humongous. People have sort of gotten over. Most people have gotten over their scientific fundamentalism. Obviously, a lot of people have. I still think I hear almost daily kind of ethical fundamentalism. But maybe there's reasons for that. Maybe that's a different.
Let's hold on to that one second. I want to respond to the first part of your comment. Biblical thought was, as thought throughout the ages, is generally based on the best evidence they have for the way that the world worked.
Uh-huh.
And
at the time.
Uh-huh. That's correct. And so as scientific views change, it's sort of like some people talk about this as a horizon of understanding or meaning, that their horizon of understanding was very different because they didn't have, I mean, science as we know it just didn't exist. Their view of the world, the physical world, was very different. And so their cosmology was a particular way because of what was being done, the way things were examined. And so that's, we need to see it in terms of the context of the time, and instead of trying to take biblical thought out of that time and bring it into our day, we need to look at it in its context and sort of try to bring the whole thing, and that with its horizon of understanding, into our day and look at our horizon of understanding and see what that biblical thought world can mean for our day. And that's, I think, where your question about ethics comes in.
Exactly.
Would you get back to
You've
that?
You've articulated it very clearly and helpfully, but that's where the question of ethics does come in.
I don't know what you mean by fundamental type or simplistic, I guess, ethics. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I hear, yeah, sure, I hear a lot of Jesus said, therefore we do, or Jesus did, therefore we do, or the Ten Commandments say, or Paul said, or, you know, it can be anywhere in the Bible.
That type of thing.
And that strikes me as being the ethical equivalent of a three-story universe. Mm. But then again, it doesn't either, because I wonder if the human experience codified in the scriptural texts, which is the way I view them, essentially, when reflecting on the human condition, it's not somewhat different in quality from when reflecting on the cosmos. That there's a more solid ground of experience.
That's a real interesting question.
To draw upon, over time. Whereas you couldn't really have any kind of real grasp of the planets. I mean, there's just no way.
Are you asking, is there some continuity, or perhaps more continuity, in human experience of social
moral
conditions,
behavior, yeah,
moral behavior,
behavior, yeah,
than there is in
I guess that's it. Yeah.
The view of the external world. Anybody else on that? That's maybe a little bit of a tough question.
It's maybe unfair because you're not talking about ethics, and
I don't mean
to lay somebody else's question on
well,
you.
Well, I do mean to be talking about ethics. I think it has implications for, and I really want to tie it into ethics, because I think that the way we view the world gives us a picture of how we deal with one another and with
uncertainty built into this. Everything isn't, as he said, Newton's song.
Yeah, right.
That requires people to have some inner core, inner direction that keeps them on the true path and able to deal with randomness, change, and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. expanding. Mm-hmm. And I don't think very many people are able to handle that.
That brings up a really important and interesting question.
Very few people. People have to be absolutely mature, adults. And I guess, to my mind, there's only been one truly mature person in the whole world, and it was Christ. And the closer you approach to him, his nature, the closer you can handle, the better you can handle that sort of thing.
You mean
people
in terms
who
of...
are truly spiritual infants can't handle this. They have to have daddy telling them everything. Not only that, they want to have daddy tell you and the next person next door how to handle it.
Mm-hmm. So that a view that is more open and
very hard to handle.
Uh-huh.
People who like to think for themselves are ostracized because they're threats. And that sort of thing is a threat to most people because it's ambiguous.
That is, if we take this into the realm of social or moral decision-making or whatever, yeah, that's assuming we're making that jump.
But I thought that's...
That's what we're talking
about. ...the resemblance of the connection where you were trying to get that
mm-hmm.
in there.
Mm-hmm. Again, I just brought that in because I want us to be clear that we are making that jump from talking about scientific theory to talking about other ways of functioning.
That's where I see the connection of the problem, and that's where I see it would be very hard to get the way society is now to implement.
Especially since historically they have gone so much hand in hand. I mean, the whole Enlightenment period of Enlightenment philosophy and secularization took place along with Newtonian view of the world, and that in turn led to the justification of things like modern racism and a lot of different things. If you attended Tom Witt's session on racism and militarism, but so much of the roots of modern racism, the whole peoples trying to control other peoples and assuming superiority, is rooted in an Enlightenment perspective with a worldview based on Newton's mechanical view that we can control things. Some things are more superior than others. So that, as you were saying, then I think the kind of worldview and the assumptions in those are just critically important in terms of the ethics and theology and politics and everything else.
They are.
Whether we recognize them or not. And that's it.
Yeah, I think so too. Any others want to jump in before I take off on that?
It's a curious reversal of Aristotle, actually, is what's happened here. Because Aristotle saw that human behavior precisely was not predictable. That is, Newton lived in Aristotle's scientific model, but not in Aristotle's philosophy of society.
But did Newton really apply his theories to anything besides the physical?
He did write about theology. Yeah, it's interesting to find that out about his thought. But I think that it's been others who've applied it to economics and economic theory, etc. But it was in Newton's writing that we get this sort of God of the gaps idea, that God was pushed into the corners where science couldn't explain things. If there was something that Newton felt that scientific theory didn't explain, he would say, though, that's where God comes in. And then as the Enlightenment moved forward and as science was able to explain more and more, it squeezed those corners smaller and smaller. And so we've come to see the problem with saying, well, what science can explain is not where God works. It's where science works, but then God works somewhere else. And so what I believe, and what I think many people who work in this field have come to see, is that God works throughout the things that science explains. It's not that they're two different realms, that we can't push God into these little corners that we think. Just because we can't explain it, that must be God. I'd like to get back to what Dan said. There's lots we can talk about here, but when Dan was talking, it reminded me of some other reading I've done, things that are in the air. I don't know if you've heard or read any of this, but a lot of people look at these views from science and look at a real desire to change the way that we view social reality, racism, as sort of a paradigm shift. And they do try to tie these things together and say that there is a shift in the way that the whole way we view the world, the physical universe, society, and spiritual things taking place in our day, and some call that paradigm shift.
From mechanistic to what? To chaos, you mean?
More open,
undeterministic,
unpredictable.
Yeah.
Some call it postmodern.
It's a curious mix of stuff because, all of us have beliefs of predictability. We believe that if we get up and walk in that direction, we'll come to the next building. Now, it could be that we wouldn't, but most of us operate day to day on a kind of more or less model of, in which there are elements, strong elements of predictability without there being certainty.
Yeah, it's important to say that, and to say that Newtonian mechanics does work on a basic level, and it continues to hold true despite the fact that these other theories work at the subatomic or huge expansive level. So
I was just going to say, like, the thing on chaos, I think the point is it's hard to understand chaos as the images it evokes for us. One thing, it's not randomness and it's not just total craziness either.
Exactly.
But one of the things, when I read a book on chaos last summer, one of the most fascinating things, that it's being used in so many different areas to make sense of things that didn't make sense, and one of the most fascinating was epidemics, trying to understand why you can think you're so close to eradicating measles or smallpox, and if you used a predictable model, you know, we cut it in half this year, we cut it in half this year, by next year we should eradicate it, only to find 2 years later it explodes again. And it hasn't fit any of the other models, but this whole understanding of chaos, the unpredictability, has helped explain that and a lot of other things. And it doesn't mean, what it means is that we'll be able to, you know, understand better.
As we model things better, right. we'll be able to understand how they work.
Right.
That's exactly right.
What one is more the difference comment. Between chaos and randomness then?
They're closely tied together. Randomness happens in a lot of different theories. Chaos is a sort of a narrow term for what, well, let me think. Chaos is the name of the theory. Randomness happens within the theory. I guess that's maybe the easiest way to explain it.
It's not an easy concept, but chaos, as I understand it, there are still patterns that can be discerned.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
They don't exist in
complicated patterns.
They're very complicated. Randomness is defined basically as the absence of pattern.
Right. Unpredictability. Yeah, with computer modeling, they are able to find patterns, but they're very complicated. Well, I just looked at my watch and realized that we're about out of time, so I think we do need to wrap things up. We've probably raised more questions than answers, but it's been a real interesting discussion. Thank you for your participation.